I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is going to be novelist Patricia Engel, and her latest book is called The Veins of the Ocean. You may recall her from a previous show about 2 years ago when her novel It's Not Love, It's Just Paris came out, and we had her on the show. I think I was with Marcia Dottestel during that interview. You can go into the archives and check it out. But this is her newest novel, and it's a great example of how organic the material in fiction can be. There is nothing forced about this novel, and it's worthwhile if you're a student of fiction writing, if you're a fiction writer, or if you just love quality fiction to pick this up and give it a read. There's a lot of characters in here, and one of the things that happens when you work on a book for a long time, I'm working on a collection of stories right now, interconnected stories with a lot of the same characters. But yesterday, I had to kill one of my characters, and it felt bad, and it was hard to do. But as I was reading this particular story, which is like 30, 40 pages long, I just knew this character. The only purpose this character served was my own ego as a writer, because I liked the character and I liked to make fun of the character and I liked, you know, messing around with the character. It was a stereotypical Texas cowboy character. And really, I was kind of mocking him in a sense. And it was at a certain point as I was reading it that I'm realizing this character is not real. This character is Daniel Chacon trying to manipulate a story because he thinks it's funny or he thinks it's clever. And I realized that I needed to take him out. So I did it. I killed him. And he pleaded. He says, "No, don't kill me. Let me live," or however Texans talk. I guess I should know. I live in Texas. But I wiped him out and he doesn't exist anymore. And the story is just so much more effective. And the choices we have to make as writers is sometimes we have to get rid of passages. Sometimes we have to get rid of characters, descriptions. Sometimes we have to get rid of whole chapters that do nothing more than amuse the writer, but that impede the story. And so maybe we can talk, Patricia, about the choices she makes in what she leaves in and what she leaves out of a novel. Oftentimes, the writer gets in the way of a novel. That writer gets in the way of a story. But the best fiction, like the best poetry, I believe is organic. It's a surprise. It comes out of somewhere. I'm not quite sure what that source is. It's been given many, many names. Today we're going to talk about an incredibly organic novel. So stick around and we'll talk to Patricia Engel. Patricia Engel is author of three novels, including Vida and It's Not Love, It's Just Paris. Vida, her first book, was a New York Times Notable Book of 2010 and a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Fiction Award. This new novel, The Veins of the Ocean, was published very recently and was named a New York Times Editor's Choice. Patricia's books have been published in multiple languages, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, A Public Space, Boston Review, Guernica, and the Harvard Review, among others. In other words, all those journals that reject me and you when we try to submit something to them. Patricia, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Well, it's always, every time you have a book, you know you have a home here for 30 minutes on a Sunday.
Thank you.
The Veins of the Ocean, your new book, still in hardback. Congratulations. It's a fantastic book. It's been receiving a lot of attention. And I want to talk to you just generally about the book and then some questions of craft, because a lot of our listeners are writers. You know, we're streamed everywhere. And so we do get a lot of writers that listen to the show. So I like to kind of ask questions about craft as well. But first, The Veins of the Ocean, Reina Castillo, your fantastic character. Tell us a little bit about how this book came about.
Well, if I go way back, the point of origin for the story really just started with a little piece of hearsay or gossip. I was in the car with my mother driving one day, and we were passing by a bridge, and she said, "Oh, you see that bridge over there? A long time ago, a man threw a baby off of that bridge."
Wow.
And she didn't know anything about why this happened or who it involved or what happened afterward. That's all she knew. And I just couldn't get this image out of my mind. So it stayed with me a long time, but I was working on other things at the time. I always thought I would come back to it and write something about it, but I didn't know how yet, and I didn't know how to approach the story. So I wrote my first book, Vida, during that time, and in about 2008, I sat down and I wrote a short story called The Bridge, which was kind of my first take into that singular image. And at the time, I when I was beginning to write it, I didn't know who would tell this story about what this event. I didn't really know how to enter it. So finally I came up with the sister of the child who was thrown off the bridge, thinking that she was close enough to have this insider access to also have the emotional access and still know all the facts and be able to tell them in a somewhat factual and objective to a point way. So I wrote that story, and you know, I write stories all the time, and usually they just stay as stories, but this story was different. So I always thought there was more, to be written, particularly, you know, about the narrator, Reina. But then I wrote another book, It's Not Love, It's Just Paris, in the meantime. And so it wasn't until many years later, about 2012 or so, when It's Not Love, It's Just Paris was already in the, you know, publication pipeline, that I sat down to write what became The Veins of the Ocean.
Wow. That, you know, it reminds me of something a great writer once said, broadcast, I believe it was. He said that when people ask him how he gets his ideas, he says he doesn't get them. He gives in to the ones that won't let him go.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like this was so striking to you that that one image was just full of so much, for lack of a better word, energy. And you let it, you know, you contained it for so long until it just kind of burst out. So does that mean that this novel, once you found the voice of Reina and once you found the language, it just grew and grew on its own?
Yes. It starts kind of very tight, very impacted, just in that event, which is, you know, violent and traumatic. But from there, I thought the whole family history would emerge.
Yeah,
the voice is part of it. The voice carries everything, the psychology and everything. And she's really the mouthpiece for the whole family.
Right.
And I wanted initially to tell a story of incarceration because that's something that has always interested me. And so it started out as that, but then I knew it would be Reina's story, and she was the one who would continue, and I wanted to follow her. I felt like she had so much to explore, undergo, and experience, and through her the story would kind of come to its spiraling conclusion.
Yeah, Reina, she's a fantastic character. I think when the novel starts, she's about 23.
Yes.
Or something, yeah. And first of all, when I picked up the novel, I thought, I really don't want to read this right now. It was like nighttime. I was going to watch Netflix. And I said, but I'll just read, the first page. But immediately it grips you with that opening image of the bridge. And then after that, it just opens up. But I think that what kept me reading was not so much the twists and turns of the plot, which do happen. I mean, a lot happens in this novel. Her brother, who is the one who threw his daughter, I believe, off the bridge, ends up in prison. And really, it begins to be a story of her every weekend, just giving up all her weekends to go to this town, stay in a cheap motel just so she could spend as much time as she can with her brother. But what really compels the narrative is really her voice and her unique experience. She really is quite a unique character. And I'm wondering how long it took you to write this. And the reason why I ask is because I want to know how long you were lingering in this voice, in this mind.
Well, yes. In many ways, yes. But I'll go back a bit. So like I said, the first story was written so long ago. So the voice started to become something there, but I didn't yet know where it would go.
Mm-hmm.
But I already had the inklings of the voice, but at the same time, I had other voices in my head, because as I mentioned, I was working on two other books.
Right, right.
So there was, I want to say that during those years when I was occupied by another project, this book was already living inside me in some ways in the very early stages. When I finally said, okay, now it's time to write this book, Raina's voice had already become very clear to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I sit down to write a book, I basically have to clear total space in my life in order to make room for it, because it just hijacks everything. I mean, it does interfere with my own life, I have
right.
to say. So yeah, it is letting that voice, and it's not just the voice. The voice is just, you know, the voice is just what you hear. It's really the mind and
right.
the heart and the conscience and the soul of that character that has to be given permission to live constantly.
Right. I'm talking to Patricia Engel. The book is The Veins of the Ocean. It's a new novel. And we're talking about, this character is so strong, and the plot seems to unfold, you know, very organically. The story unfolds organically. We get glimpses of her past, and then she goes back to the present, glimpses of her past. And it's just effortless the way it goes in and out of time space. I know I've written characters, or I've had characters with me for so long, that sometimes I find myself looking through things at their perspective, even when I'm not writing. But I'm also wondering about, there's this wonderful part where she meets this Cuban man named Nestor, who really just wants to bring his kids from Havana to Florida, and is working solely for that. And seems to be his complete focus. But one of the things he evokes and brings to this novel is his immersion, or the orisha, the spirits that he conjures and that he believes guides him and guides everybody. And I'm imagining, since he tells such beautiful stories about the orisha, like the origins of the universe and the origins of the ocean, that a lot of research went into that. Unless you already were kind of dabbling in the orisha. But I'm wondering if, as you're doing that and as you're inside the voice of this character, if that pulled you into this world even more and caused you to perhaps even see things differently as you were writing this.
Yeah, absolutely. I do really extensive research no matter what I'm writing. And in this case, it's not only the question of getting the voice of the narrator right, of course,
mm-hmm.
that's really important, but it's getting all the voices right, because they're all so different.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, I understood that I needed to go to Cuba. So I started going to Cuba. I went something like 10 times
mm-hmm.
while working on this book. Yeah, 8 or 10 times. And that, the reason why I went so many times is because every time I went, the more I learned, the more I became aware of, you know, my ignorance, basically. So, you know, in this country, we're sort of more exposed to the Cuban exile narratives in American literature, but not so much of the life of the Cubans who remained after the revolution,
right.
what life has been like now. And that's really what I was interested in. So it would be impossible and completely disingenuous for me to write about life in Cuba now from the perspective of an ordinary Cuban like Nesto is, Afro-Cuban, and ignore the whole Santeria element.
Right, absolutely.
The Afro-Cuban religions, which is so prevalent there now more than ever. So he's a character who's not a strict practitioner, but certainly a believer. And in order to write him and to understand him, I had to understand how that would affect the perspective and the life of somebody who holds that as part of their faith.
Right.
So I did a lot of research there in Cuba. I read about 100 books.
Wow.
Do
your research.
And I spent a lot of time in the Asociación Cultural Yoruba de Cuba, Casa Los Orishas, which is a practicing Santería temple, and went to lots of ceremonies, spoke to lots of practitioners and experts and elders within the community, and as I spent more time with them, they were more and more open with me, and I learned quite a bit, and I have enormous respect for it. I'm not a practitioner myself, but I have tremendous, tremendous respect for it.
Well, at first, as Reina is exposed to Nesto's belief system, she kind of rejects it or is indifferent about it at the very least. But after a while, she begins to kind of respect it as well. And perhaps it even allows her to shift her consciousness a bit. Like, for example, that wonderful scene with, and I love this, by the way, the dolphin with psychological issues. Zoe, with the dolphin with psychological issues. She connects with Zoe, and when she helps Zoe, helps this dolphin in, you know, a way that she's really not supposed to do, she thinks, well, maybe she is kind of repaying one of the spirits in doing that, and you could see her consciousness shift slightly. And I'm wondering if the studying of that really kind of just helped you to see reality just slightly different at times.
Well, I've lived in Miami for about 12 years now, and I live next to the oceans. And I moved here from New York City.
Oh wow!
So for me, it was a great departure from urban life to live so close to the ocean, and observe how people who live close to the ocean really go about their lives quite differently. And I started to become interested in this and how, you know, the way we see and experience the natural world affects who we are as people and even our relationships in some ways. So one of the things that I appreciate most about the Afro-Cuban religions is their connection to the natural world. Mm-hmm. And the connections that they draw between their faith and you know what is actually here present on Earth that we see and experience every day, like the ocean, the sun, the moon, the trees, the earth, the forests, everything, and all life really. So Reina, who was raised more or less traditionally religious, but has come to a point as a result of her experiences where she kind of rejects it. She has lost her faith, she says quite openly, as a result of what her family's experienced. And on the other hand, Nesto, who grew up in a society like Cuba where religion was openly rejected and even forbidden, somehow has cultivated this great sense of faith. So I was interested in that. Where does faith come from? How does it survive? How does it sustain? And at times it can be sustained on very little. So yeah, Reina begins to open herself up, not so much to this idea of, you know, faith in the great beyond, but that we're a part of this system, this natural order in the world. And as Nesta starts to share his belief system with her, she starts to realize that there might be some sort of logic to it in repaying the debts of her family, as is said in the novel. By honoring nature.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because one of the reviewers called this a coming-of-age novel.
Yeah.
And I didn't really think of it that way
it's
as
funny.
I was reading.
It's funny, they always do that with women. They never call male novels.
Yeah, because she's already of age, you know? She's already of age. She's already independent. She's already an incredibly strong character. But yeah, there is character development. It's really absorbing watching her consciousness shift and to realize that somebody who has the outward appearance of not wanting to be involved in a relationship, except for one that became close to being traditional, that really in many ways, she has this one line. She says, if she were married, she would be the most faithful woman in the world. But nobody ever, you know, thought about marrying her. They just kind of used her for various other reasons. But it's really wonderful to watch her develop perspective, because really it's in many ways her learning to develop that raw love that she has. It's a story about love. It's a love story, but it's not a romantic love story per se. It's more like reconciling with love.
Yeah, it's in my mind it becomes Nessa and Reina's relationship comes out of a sort of companionship. They're two very, you know, adrift people. They fall into this companionship without expectation, and from there, kind of their essences can emerge, and they can be, you know, really honest about who they are.
Yeah. A lot of English majors, undergraduates, when they're going to read this in their courses, because I'm sure this will be assigned reading in many literature courses. It's a beautiful novel. They're going to make the connection, Reina Castillo, Queen Castle, you know, and they're going to even, you know, say Queen of the Castle. And they're going to, you know, make these parallels between being a queen of a castle and her being the queen of her own life, constructing her own kingdom, as it were, or queendom. Did you do this on purpose, or did you just allow the meaning to be in a name that you chose because of the way it sounded?
Yeah, I did not do it on purpose, but that's kind of the fun thing about writing sometimes is your subconscious is doing things you're not even aware of. So So, you know, in my experience, Reina is a pretty common name.
Yeah, absolutely. So is Castillo.
As is Castillo. So it's not like I, you know, reached very far to name my characters. You know, it stuck. It just, sometimes the name just kind of hits me, and it's like the characters name themselves. And I don't even fight it, and I don't try to, you know, come up with more symbolic names or anything.
Yeah.
It just felt true to her. So I thought, oh, there's some connections here, but I wasn't really thinking about it.
You know, I didn't think you were, and that's the reason why I wanted to mention it, because we have a lot of writers that listen to this show, and one of the things that I truly believe is that, you know, if you enter into a novel and the process, the writing itself, the process becomes, you know, there's surprises all along the way. You know, the process is what gives form to the book, as opposed to, you know, writing an outline for everything that has to happen in every part, that we do that. We choose based on language. We choose a lot of things just on sound, just on the poetry of it, or just on the, you know, the
even
rhythm
just on
of it.
Instinct.
Yeah. You know? And I think one of the reasons your character, Reina Castillo, it does not seem like, oh, she's trying to hit us over the head, is that your character is incredibly fleshed out, a real person. All your characters are. And I'm wondering if you could give fiction writers advice on techniques that you use to deepen character, to make them real.
Well, a lot of it comes from making sure there's not too many characters, so that each character must be absolutely essential to the story. And I think about that a lot, and I think, could I just get rid of this character? What would be lost? You know, what are they bringing to the story? How are they moving it forward? And it's not about serving the plot. It's about serving the story and the narrator as well.
Yeah.
But in order to differentiate them, I have to go so far back to think, you know, we think of language just in the written form, or we look in the sentence level and things like that, but we don't always remember that everything that comes out of our own mouths has to do with every experience we've ever had in our life up until now, even down to the tone or the pitch of our voice or the volume at which we speak. You know, we learn at what volume we're supposed to speak by the way we are raised in our homes. So much comes down to the personal history of the characters and determining what that is and how that would make them present themselves on the page by the way they speak, the way they move, the way they stand, the way they appear, their gestures, the way they interact with one another. And I work very hard at that, especially, you know, when you're dealing with several men on the page.
Right. Uh-huh.
You know, how do you make them all sound different as individuals do? Right? If you had that, you know, in a crowded room, everybody sounds different. Or even have the daughter, how is she different from her mother? And of course, it's because the mother has lived an entirely different life.
Right.
You know, I don't want her just to be like the maternal mouthpiece.
Right.
Know? She's a woman in her own right. So a lot of it is allowing the characters to have their own lives, and then just choosing the moments in which their lives are going to come out in that conversation or in those bits of dialogue.
As you're writing this novel, and as you're going into these characters, and as you're giving them the past, I imagine many times something happened to them or some part of their past was revealed that was even a surprise to you. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about those surprises in this novel.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are the things that you can never plan for. They just come up as you're writing. Many times it's happened, several instances were with the character of Reina. She's a young woman, but she's also sort of, because her mother's a single mom and they've had this kind of terrible family history about them, she's on her own in a lot of ways, even though she has a brother who in his own way tries to protect her.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it has to do with the ways I wanted to show that Reina has narrowly escaped terrible situations many, many, many times in her life. You know, and in ways that she's not even aware of. That's kind of something I wanted to explore, which is kind of a footnote of young womanhood that we don't really think about that much in society, is that I don't want to say young women are at risk, but in a way they are. They're quite vulnerable. So Reina, despite her toughness, has been quite vulnerable and didn't even know her own rights as a young woman in many different ways. So, you know, there's times when you see Reina going back in her own memory and sort of understanding trauma she didn't even know she had, or times, you know, when she got into a car with somebody who's going to do God knows what to her, or, you know, she's in the swimming pool as a young child, and the father of another child, you know, starts, you know, doing things around her. So these are things that came up in the writing as well. And also there were moments between Reina and her brother Carlito when they were children that I wanted to show sort of how they were kind of figuring out their own life on their own in a lot of ways, because their mother was too preoccupied with her own struggles to give them maybe as much attention as they should have had.
You know, I always tell students, I teach in an MFA program, and I always tell students that probably, an impulse for a novel or an impulse for a story it probably has more of a chance to grow organically if it's an image that won't let them go, or even if it's an incantation or a sound, as opposed to themes. And we know there are themes in good novels, and this book has a lot of themes in them, but of course they come out as part of the fabric, as opposed to theme first and then the characters are dragged around in order to show a theme. But there's this wonderful line in the voice of Reina. She says, "I've never had trouble forcing hope, even when there was none to speak of, but faith has always seemed much more dangerous." Is this a theme of the novel? And if it is, did it happen, or did you know that this theme would play itself out?
Yeah, that's something that originated with the idea of writing about families enduring incarceration sort of alongside their loved ones who are the ones physically serving the sentence. I wanted to explore how families reconcile the love they have for somebody who has committed a terrible crime. Of course, the law has, you know, creates these, you think they're opportunities for appeals and pardoning by the state and things like that. And people have a lot of hope for things like that. Of course, hope against hope. So the idea of hope originated with that, but I also wanted to explore how that permeates into the other aspects of Reina's life. She has very little hope for certain aspects mm-hmm. of her life, but she has so much hope in other ways. And that also went along with Nesto, who has lived in a society where he was bred and raised not to have any hope whatsoever.
Right.
Yet he does. He does have sustained so much hope for the future of his family.
Yeah. Well, it's a great example, I think, of how novels could be written and or should be written. And I'm even using this. I'm teaching a graduate seminar called Forms and Techniques of Fiction, one of our gateway courses, and I'm using this book in the class because it's just a wonderful book to look at to see, you know, what writers can do. And so congratulations on this book. I wish you the best of luck on it.
Oh, thank you so much, Daniel. Thanks so much for having me again.
And anytime you have a book, you know, like I said, you're the book has a home here at Words on a Wire. Thank you very much, and we'll look out for the next one.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to thank my guest, Patricia Engel, for joining me this week. The name of the novel is The Veins of the Ocean. I'd also like to thank Norma Martinez, our producer. Join us again every week on Words on a Wire. I'm Daniel Chacon. Have a great afternoon.